Today's podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
All right, let's get back in here on Diamond Conversations. And joining me on the line today on this new episode of Diamond Conversations, exclusively here on the Place to Be Nation podcasting network, is 10-year Major League Baseball pro. He was a Philly, he was a Brave, he was a Rocky, he was with the White Sox. He is the one and only Mr. Marvin Freeman joining me today. Mr. Freeman, how's everything in your neck of the woods?
It's all good, man. What's up with you? It's hot, hot down here.
It's hot here, too. I'm in Virginia, and it's no better. I just took out the garbage, and it was roasting.
Yeah. Absolutely. Me too, man. So I was trying to stay cool right now, and hopefully later on this evening, help some pitchers get better.
That's right, yeah, and I appreciate you taking some time out of your schedule. When we talked last week, you were in the middle of your pitching sessions. You're very active, and you're very on top of the youth and building them for the future. So, kind of talk about that. And you're a busy man, so I appreciate the few minutes today. But talk about your pitching schedule and all the great things you're doing.
So basically, I'm just training youth pitchers. Since we have in this pandemic, haven't been able to do my usual MLB youth development series that we usually do, the Breakthrough Series, the Dream Series, Hank Aaron Classic, and things of those natures that we do for high school pitchers and players throughout the summer. So been pretty much local at my own academy out here doing pitching training and working with a lot of kids before the draft, work with a lot of potential draft picks before they actually either got drafted or didn't get drafted. We were hoping for a lot more, but got two guys drafted this year in the first three rounds. So that was pretty exciting for them and their families. But I'm just really just trying to give these guys an opportunity to learn how to pitch as opposed to just throw. You know, right. So much has been put on the analytics side with the numbers and the measurements and all of this stuff. But once you get on the mound, you still got to be able to locate, change speeds, and have more than one pitch. So those are the areas that I cover. I leave all this velocity to the Velo Farms. I don't sell velocity. I teach pitching.
Oh, no, that's great. Yeah, you're very active on social media, sharing the videos of the guys that you're working with and breaking down pitching, you know, to its barest form. And it's really fascinating to watch. But, you know, you've said with the quarantine, you know, it's funny. The first few weeks we weren't really allowed to do much. But as we saw things start to open up, I mean, it seems like for kids who need development, you know, once they get done with their schooling hours, I mean, they kind of have like the free time to really focus on working on themselves, and versus maybe the pro guys that, you know, were kind of sitting around and waiting. The kids that are learning kind of have this like unlimited amount of time that they can really think baseball, you know, almost like 24/7. And it's, I guess, one of the benefits of kind of being stuck in the house. You can work on your game and make yourself a better player.
Yeah, you know, I put out a home workout that these guys can do. A lot of times I'm not just talking to kids that have backyards. A lot of these kids are living in apartments. Some of them are up north where the weather won't allow them to get outside, but there are still things that they can do inside the house to kind of bridge the gap on getting ready to pitch whenever that time comes. And down here in Georgia, these guys are back in their full swing now. They're playing games and they're playing tournaments like they didn't have any time off at all. So they jump right back into it. And most of the guys that I've been working with or have been throwing with me since January made a smooth transition back into games. Whereas a lot of the kids that weren't doing anything, now their arms are sore because they tried to go from doing nothing to getting right back in it full swing. And right. It was a warning that I put out on my Instagram a month ago saying that don't go out there and think that you're going to be 100%. But once adrenaline kicks in and you get a hitter up there, you're trying to get them out. So you're not thinking about trying to save anything. So I try to leave that up to some of the coaches to have, you know, pretty good decision-making skills so that they're not out there trying to win the dreaded ribbon in June when it really means nothing, but to keep developing these kids' arms and bring them along slowly so that they can be healthy far beyond just this summer season.
Today's athlete, you know, they learn different ways. They kind of, you know, they find different ways to work out. You know, there's always been a new emphasis on new training methods. Like, how have you seen today's kids and today's athletes changing from maybe guys you even taught 5 years ago?
Well, you know, I see a lot of younger kids doing things like lifting weights, doing power lifting and things of that nature. I don't, you know, I kind of frown on that until they get to a certain age, because a lot of these kids haven't fully developed physically. And so they're trying to do things that they see online on the internet that 21, 22, 27 year old grown men are doing, like throwing weighted balls. When you're 14, your growth plates are open, and you know, there's so many things that can go wrong if you're doing it wrong. And just to look at something on the internet and then go out in your garage and try it is kind of dangerous for their arm care. I do see a lot of kids trying to get a little bit more effort into each throw. Instead of learning how their body's supposed to move or what they need to do to capitalize on the pitches that they already have, everybody is velocity hunting.
Right.
So, I mean, when you get out on the mound, doesn't really matter how hard you throw to a hitter. Hitters don't really fear a fastball that's just hard. But if you can control it, if you can spot it, you can command it, and then you got a three-pitch mix like a changeup or breaking ball that you can mix in with that, a lot of that stuff is going to be more conducive to having success. So basically, I see kids now just trying to throw the ball as hard as they can. And, you know, everybody loves velocity. When I was pitching and I looked up at the ray gun on the scoreboard and I had a good number up there, you know, I poked my chest out a little bit. I understand that, you know, it's like hitting a home run 500 feet or hitting one 300 feet. It's still a home run.
Right.
It's still going to be the same result. It's the same way if you get a guy out. I hear so many kids talking about, oh, I'm going to strike everybody out. Well, that's unrealistic. And if you go out there with that approach, then you really don't have an idea of how to get outs other than striking people out. So I see a lot of kids trying to strike everybody out and trying to throw as hard as they possibly can. And that's just the recipe for a short career or the chances of arm injuries increasing.
Yeah, it's weird because, like, you know, you just use the mental, you know, knowledge of weights. If you put too much stress on muscles inside the arm, sooner or later, things are going to pop, things are going to tear, and things are not going to be in the same place they were before. You know, and I just saw a video of Noah Syndergaard, who had Tommy John surgery a few weeks ago, like pushing his limits. He was doing, you know, like he was doing cardio work. He was doing kind of intensive, you know, running and jumps and stuff. But if he's trying to rehab his arm, I don't know how much like his legs and his, you know, his stamina is going to help as the arm isn't back to where it is. And I don't know if that's going to put an extra stress on the arm, but the weights itself seem to be a natural thing. They stress your muscles. And if after time, they're not going to work the way they did before. And I kind of see an emphasis on that. It's that it muscles, you know, the velocity gets out the hitter, but the hitter is doing the same kind of weight work and he's trying to hit it 900 feet. So there's kind of a weird give and take. I don't think pitchers and hitters should be doing the same kind of, you know, workout regimens.
Well, I mean, as far as the physical strength is concerned, I understand that. I understand you want to be in the best shape that you can be in. You want to have, you know, rock hard abs. You want to have bulging biceps. But pitching, you know, your lower half is what's going to drive your engine. If your lower half is out of sync and you're just trying to do everything with your arm, then you're going to have some problems. Like with Syndergaard, I saw he was throwing 100. He wanted to throw 105. Like, everybody wants to throw harder. And you see now that, you know, the way that they use pitchers is almost like disposable lighters. You get a couple strikes out of them, and then when they blow out, then they bring the next one up. The longevity factor has kind of disappeared because I don't think they want guys to have 20 years in the league. You see so many relievers being used in a game that the starter is only expected to go five innings now.
Right.
And so if the starter is only expected to go five innings, why should he try and pace himself to get somebody out three times? He's going to go out there and going to let it all hang out. I mean, when I was a reliever, I had one job to do. Come in with the game on the line in the seventh, eighth, ninth inning and go as hard as I could, as long as I could. But you see starters taking that mentality now. And, you know, it's going just going to really make the elite starting pitcher stand out more. And then guys that don't really have that that pitch combination or the understanding of how to read a hitter and get them out three times, those guys are going to fall by the wayside. Because, again, with the way baseball has been played last year, you see pitchers taking cards out of the back pocket to look and see how they're going to pitch
right.
the guy.
Yeah.
So it's not even – they're not even – I don't even think they're letting these guys call their own games. Because the analytics say, hey, if your slider is your best pitch, throw it 90% of the time. Okay, so if it's your best pitch and it's a pitch that you use to get guys out with, if you throw it more, they're going to see it more, subsequently making it less effective.
Right.
So when guys can mix in their pitches, when guys can throw their breaking balls for strikes, and when guys can kind of set a hitter up for later on in the game, then you'll see guys starting to go seven, eight, and nine innings again. But until then, you get seven relievers ready. You get your starter to give you three innings, and then you just start bringing guys in like a freaking conga line. You know, but it's really changed the game the way that it's being actually coached from upstairs now.
Right.
Managers don't really get a chance to go with their gut feeling. Everybody's so afraid that they're going to get second guessed if they go with a feel and not go with what's on paper. And that's why you see the game is, you know, a little bit different than it used to be. There's not a lot of strategy, like bunting guys over, hitting behind guys, hitting and running. You know, you see guys swinging for the gate. You see pitchers trying to strike everybody out. So who wants to see a game where it's 15 home runs and 20 strikeouts? I mean, that's okay. That's like showcase baseball. You go to a showcase and you're just trying to show what you can do. And that really doesn't play into a team aspect. So, you know, all us old dinosaur guys have pretty much the same argument about how the game has changed. And when I was coming up, I used to hear from guys that was a lot older than me telling us that we didn't know what we were doing. So it's not new. It's just something that you always get better after you get out of the game. You know, everybody's a lot smarter in the booth. All the players are great players once they're out of the game. If you look at my Instagram and like a lot of kids that I coach, they're like, Coach, you should be in the Hall of Fame. You never gave up a hit. You didn't get it. Nobody ever got a hit off you. Well, I control that narrative. So if I want guys to really see what I can do, I'm not going to put up a game where I'm getting pounded.
Right.
I'm going to put up some stuff that I have success with. But I'm so, you know, I got so many videos from when I played. I can just pick through and find out whatever I've been talking about at the previous lesson and use that as an example. Just so these guys will know that I've been through almost every circumstance that a pitcher can be in. Starter, reliever, setup, mop up, clean up, whatever was asked of me, I've been able to do that. So that's the credibility factor that I can bring to the training aspect of what I'm doing. So if they know that I've done it at the highest level and then I can teach that, then now I'm getting a better response or they're coming to me with questions that normally they wouldn't ask because, you know, sometimes they just figure, well, how's he going to know what I'm feeling? But,
right.
You know, again, by going through it, there's some things that I can relate to these guys that they just can't get by looking on somebody else's YouTube page.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll tell you, that's what I love about, you know, what you do on social media is I love the footage. I love your archive. you know, basically like you think about a player and then you got a video up of you up, you know, on the mound against them. And it's so cool when you break it down and you're saying how you're getting them out and you're using your strategy as a, you know, as a guy who's an enthusiast of the MLB archive myself. I mean, I absolutely love this footage that you pull out. So you have basically all your games on video, correct? And you were able to go to a game and pull it out and check in, see, you know, what you did in these games for success. And it's so cool to see you do that.
Yeah, you know, when I first started playing, we had the video guy and they would record every game. And then after the season, they would ask guys, hey, do you want your videos, your VHS tapes, cassettes? I'm like, yeah, you know, I might not be here next year. So I still want to have something. I was like, I had this forethinking that at some point I'm going to have kids and they're going to, you know, they're going to want to see what dad did. So I better try and hold on to this video. And then every year after the season, I just got all my videos. And then maybe about 3 or 4 years after I retired, I was like, well, you know, these VHS, I don't think they're going to last forever. Let me put them all in my computer. So I got them digitized, put them in my computer. Now I can just go to like Baseball Reference and find out the date of the game, bring it up, and then I can go in there and actually find some footage. A lot of my guys that I play against, they're going, what about that home run I hit off you? Why you didn't put that in? I'm like, dude, this is Freeman baseball, man. I mean, like I said, I'm controlling this narrative over here.
You have shown though where you have made a mistake and then how you corrected it, and that's what gets that's accountability at its best, where you show what you did to fix those mistakes. But I just, you know, I love where you could pull out the clips of you versus Barry Bonds and you're like, look, this is what it took to get him out, watch what I do here, and look, your first at bat, last at bat. I mean, it's that kind of stuff, you know, as a video guy myself who digitizes my old sports tapes basically every other day. Love it. I could watch your stuff, you know, till the cows come home.
Good, man. I appreciate it. And that's why I do it. It's not only is it an educational thing, but I try to add a little entertainment factor with it as well. I don't put a lot of stuff up there where I'm getting pounded. I do share a little bit of hits and downsides just so guys can know that it's going to happen. I mean, no matter who you are, when you go out there, you're going to get hit. And I try to analyze why I got hit so that guys can kind of take something away from it. Now, most of the time, guys just see a video of me and they go ahead and move on. And like, oh, this guy putting another video of himself up again. He's feeling himself again, you know. So, I mean, I do get a special fuzzy feeling by putting those up. But at the same time, there's a teaching lesson involved in that as well. So I'm really trying to let these young guys know that, hey, there's more to the game than just throwing hard. I threw hard when I first came up. And as I evolved and got older, I learned how to pitch more and kind of conserve some of that early energy and learning how my body was working. I learned how to move better. I put a side-by-side video up when I was a rookie. And then right at the end of my career, things were pretty much similar, but you can see how I refined it. I took out a lot of wasted motion. I used to go over my head with my hands starting off, and all that did was put me a little bit out of sync more often than I wanted to. And then I start just not taking my hands over my head. My control got better. I had better balance. And so I really learned, and especially being on a team like the Braves, where you got Leo Mazzoni. And he's working with Hall of Famers. We didn't know they were Hall of Famers. I just knew those guys were good. So I was looking at what they were doing when they prepared, and the things that they were doing when they prepared, I was like, I've been doing it all wrong. You know, I've been preparing wrong. I've been preparing like it's the seventh game of the World Series. Well, you ain't gonna play in the seventh game of the World Series every time out there. So there has to be, you got to temper that down a little bit. And so I start preparing myself, you know, to hit outside, to hit inside, throw my breaking ball for a strike, throw my breaking ball that looked like a strike and ended up a ball, work on my changeup, and do things that I was able to repeat so that when I got in the game, if I landed wrong and fell off and I saw the ball flight, I would have an idea how to make those adjustments immediately. But when I came up with the Phillies, it was like, God, what am I doing? What am I doing? I was just out there on real athleticism and just going out there just trying to compete. but actually learning how to pitch, I didn't really learn until I got on the team with different guys that were successful. We had five, at one time, we had five Cy Young Award winners on the roster.
Yeah.
We had Art Davis and Steve Bedrosian. They won the Rolaids Relief Man, and they were in our bullpen. And then we had Smoltz, Maddox, Glavin in the rotation. Steve Avery was a 18, 19-year-old rookie. And so everybody that went out there was putting it, they was dealing, they was getting it done. And so me as a pitcher, I can't be bringing up the rear. So it's only going to make you up your game when you got guys out there that's performing and they're doing things the right way. And you're a complete idiot if you don't watch and learn what these guys are doing.
Yeah, those 91, 92, 93 early Brave teams of that run that they went on in the 90s. I mean, like, those are the teams to watch because that was watching the team come together. And, yeah, Maddox came in as, you know, big-time free agent. But, you know, Glavin was homegrown, and a lot of the guys that they had were homegrown. And we got to see them kind of mix in with the guys they acquired. And those 91, 92, 93 teams really were, like, I think the most fun to watch because you saw everybody kind of blossoming at the same time. And it was like – just like the 92, 93 Blue Jays. Everybody just kind of hit the right spot at the same time, and it made for these epic teams. But kind of talk about those early Dynasty year Brave teams and how they kind of came together and made what the Dynasty was for the whole run of the 90s.
Yeah, you know, when I first came over to the Braves, it was 1990. I came over from Philly, and my first time I pitched in Atlanta, it might have been 7,000 people in the stands. I mean, you can hear the beer guy in the upper deck and in the outfield going screaming for beers. So it was really not a lot of pressure. So as a young up and coming major leaguer, to be able to go out there and not have that self-induced pressure put on you that you pitching in front of a packed house and you got to get it done or you're going back down to the minors, that was kind of put on the back burner and you were able to kind of focus on, I'm like, hey, the Braves, they're in last place, man. If I can't make this team, I'm not going to be in the big league. So, again, it kind of made you want to be a little bit more consistent so that you're better than the guys that's getting ready to get sent out. And then that following year, they brought in John Schuerholz. Bobby Cox went from being the GM to the manager. They changed the culture of the Braves from being just the lovable, well, that's the Cubs, the lovable losers. I'm from Chicago too, so I know about them as well. But the Braves brought in Terry Pendleton, Rafael Belliard, because they needed a shortstop that could catch the ball. We had Sid Breen, they brought him in. They brought a lot of veteran leadership in. And then to go along with Dave Justice and Ron Gant,
yep,
guys that they grew as well. It was just, you know, you can see they were putting together something that was really special. And we started off the year like we always did at the All-Star break. I think we were like 10, 11 games out. And then we came back after the All-Star break, and it was like everything just came together. And we picked up we picked up about 8 games on the Dodgers in about a month span, got back in the race. And then by August, every game meant either first place or second place. So when we came to the park, it's 50,000. They're there before BP. I mean, it was like, man, this is what winning looks like. And so we just had a wonderful, wonderful experience from 91 to 94. When I left, it was being on the Braves was the in vogue thing then. So that was a great experience. And even to this day, the guys that were on that team, we still kind of, you know, communicate with each other. And we have a lot of fun talking about how things were in the clubhouse, because that was one of the few teams where everybody on the team got along. There was no cliques in the clubhouse. There was no sections off over here and over there. Everybody mingled with each other, and we were all pulling for each other. And you can just tell when a team has that type of chemistry, they're going to go out there and they're going to play hard, and they're going to play hard for a long time.
Yeah, and they won in 95, so you just, you know, a year or so removed from leaving when they finally did win that world championship, but not like you guys weren't close. I mean, we've seen the games a million times. I mean, which one of those years that you guys were right in there in the thick of it did you think that you should have won? Or I mean, you probably think you should have won them all, but which weird kind of disappoints you the most when you think about it?
Probably the 91 series. We're going all the way down to the wire with Minnesota. We had a chance in game seven. Jack Morris and Smoltz were pitching gems. They both went nine innings. Morris went 10. We ended up losing 1-0, but we had an opportunity. We had the bases loaded and no outs, and we couldn't get it done. And that was the first time I'd seen a bunch of grown men crying in the dugout, I mean, in the locker room after the game. So it was kind of painful because we had come from being the worst team in the league to playing in the World Series, and the expectations were high. And, you know, Atlanta had never won a major championship, and everybody was putting everything that they had into it. We still ended up with a million people at the parade, which was tremendous. But I think 91 was probably the most painful because nobody expected us to get there. And then when we got there, we were trying to get it all. But then 92, it was harder because everybody expected us. And then getting back to the World Series and then losing to the Blue Jays,
right?
You know, that was tough as well. But the Blue Jays had several Hall of Fame guys on their team as well. So it was not like they just snuck in there and beat us. Them guys was pretty good as well. So, but for me, I ended up having back surgery in September of 91. So I was reduced to a cheerleader, and I was just sitting on the bench, giving guys high fives, just being eaten up inside because I wanted to be a part of that September run. But still can't argue with what we did. 10, 12 flags in a row in the National League. Well, we were in the West End.
Yeah.
National League West. And it was just, it's something that, you know, everybody that was involved should be proud of because it's not easy to do.
Yeah. And just to touch back to when you got drafted, that 84 draft featured your Braves teammates, Maddox, Glavine, who got picked two picks before you, Jeff Blauser. So and that was that 84 draft featured a lot of those Braves guys. So like I said, it's kind of everybody coming together at the right time. But before I get into the wrap up, I just want to bring up your first major league win. So I'm a Mets fan. I don't know if you can see it here. I'm a Mets guy. 86. So you make your debut or you get your first win in 86, 2 days after they clinch the 1986 pennant. So you don't have the whole A lineup. You might have guys getting a day off here or there, but you got Strawberry, you got Carter, Dykstra's in there. Talk about taking a mound for that first win in New York, you know, in that season where those guys were like, you know, insanely dominant. What was that like getting your first win in New York, 86?
Well, it was, I was on the treadmill and I was watching that game. You know, I always watch old videos of myself so that I can kind of go back into the mindset of what I was thinking then as opposed to how I'm teaching now. Because if I know exactly what the pitcher is thinking and then I can see if he's executing or not, which is me, that's why I use a lot of my examples because I know what I'm thinking. But that game against the Mets, it was my second big league start. And my wife was like days away from having our first child. And so she went into labor actually right before the game, but she didn't call me. She didn't tell me because she knew it was my big league. It was my second big league start. And in New York, the Mets, they were just a hot team then. So I guess she didn't want to upset me or get me off my cue and have me fly home. So I didn't find out that she had went into labor until like the fourth inning when she had our daughter Paris. And so when the game started, I was like, boy, this is the Mets. This is the Big Apple. Look around. Packed house. I'm warming up in the pen. And the Mets fans down in the bullpen, if you know anything about Old Shea Stadium,
you could
like lean over the fence and you're right on top of the pitcher's head in the
mound.
And they were just giving me all kind of grief down there, man. Yeah, rookie, you're going to get it today. This is what's going to happen to you. Daryl Strawberry going to take you deep. I'm like, all right, okay. Y'all don't know about me. So the first batter, and when I got on the mound, you know, the mound was illegal. It was illegal. The mound was about 15 inches high. And I knew they had Gooden. They had all these good pitchers. And I'm like, no, one of these guys is so good. They're throwing the ball from an airplane down to the plate. So I'm like, I'm going to be getting some good downhill tilt on this baby. So just really the first batter was Dykstra trying to get used to the mound. I walked him. Then he got thrown out trying to steal second. And then after that, it was Dykstra, Wally Backman, Dave Magadan, Gary Carter, Daryl Strawberry, Danny Heap, Hojo, Rafael Santana, and the pitcher.
John Mitchell. Yeah, you just nailed exactly. The lineup. I'm looking at it right here. You just nailed it top to bottom.
Yeah. And so, you know, I'm like, you know, only guys that I really, you know, got to really try and not get embarrassed with was like Hojo, Straw, because Hojo was crushing. Danny Heap, he was a pretty good left-handed hitter. Gary Carter, we all know the kid can rake. And then Dave Magadan, he might have hit 300 that year. So these guys, they didn't put like the September call-ups in. And Daryl Strawberry ended up getting a hit in the second inning. He got a triple off me. And he ended up scoring on a pass ball. And as I'm covering home plate, Dutch Rennert was the umpire. And Dutch, if you know Dutch Rennert, he was like, he had his own show going back there. He was, strike one! He was like, I think they patterned that Leslie Nielsen character about after him for that movie. But Dutch Rennert said to me as I'm backing up home, and I'm covering home on the wild, on the pass ball. I say it's a pass ball because it didn't bounce. But it was a pass ball, and Dutch said to me, he said, hey, kid, you're going to be all right. Stay right there. You know, I'm going to call him. I like to hear myself call strikes, so throw a lot of them. And that kind of relaxed me because after that I was like, you know, okay, it's just like when I was in Double-A. Let me just go ahead and focus on hitting the glove. And that's when I learned that taking away the outside noise and things that I couldn't control and just worry about what I could control was just trying to keep my body and get my body in the right position and make this pitch. That was a real good life learning experience that I still teach to this day, because I can't worry about who's in the dugout when it's a guy at the plate with 30 home runs. I got to be worrying about getting him out. So trying to make the pitch, trying to make every pitch a good pitch, that's how I kind of reduced the stress level. And went out there and I looked up, it was in the fourth inning. Glenn Wilson came flying out of the locker room saying, hey man, your wife just had the baby. Everything is good. He says, go out there and get the win. And at that point we were losing 1-0 and I'm walking up and down the dugout. I'm like, hey man, I'm a father. Let's go. I want to win. I got to get this win. We put up a 4 spot that inning. I pitched 7, jumped on the flight back to Chicago. And the rest is history. I got my first child and my first win on the same day.
Unbelievable. 7 innings pitched, 1 hit, 6 strikeouts. That's a hell of a first day of birth for your child. That's very cool. So I was looking for the game. Can't find it anywhere. So as we're talking, I got a game from 88 up here. So
I'm going to do I was just when I was on the treadmill and I was looking, I said, you know what? I'm going to put every out that I got in one clip. So look for that on Twitter later on.
Oh, I absolutely will.
Put every out up there. I'm not going to put the walks or it's only 1 hit. I might throw that in there just to show that I only gave up 1 hit. But, it's still a game that I'm really, really I watch it often because, again, all those minor league bus rides and road trips and sleeping in these little flea bag hotels, you dream about that moment. And then to actually perform in it and have some success, you know, it's just something it's really hard to explain the feeling that I have when I go back and recall those things. But, you hear guys say all the time, well, you know, after my career is over, I'm going to look back on these things and then I'll probably be able to enjoy them. And that's what I'm doing now. I'm looking back and enjoying the things that I've done, you know, when I played in the big leagues.
That's awesome. All right. So we're going to get into the wrap right here. And, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about Freeman Baseball. I'll let you tell everybody where they can find everything for your foundation, for Freeman Baseball. But, you know, I wanted to say, just as we wrapped up, you know, when I wanted to talk with you, I mean, I've been watching you guys. And I mean the vets, the pros, battling, you know, the new age gurus and the guys that never stepped over the white lines in the major leagues and giving you guys hell and ripping the old guard, which I'm calling it reverse jockism. For some reason, it's become acceptable to, like, bully former pros for making the bigs. I don't get it. But you guys have been fighting a good fight.
That's all the hitting gurus. The pitching guys, they can't really dispute anything that I say, because not only am I getting results from the guys that I work with, they're actually using a lot of my stuff the way that they're training pitchers now. So Mostly I get on guys that put up some really crazy hitting tips, and I'm all for it. I want hitters to be as confused as possible. I don't want them to know that a pitcher is going to be trying to really dominate the outside corner. I want everybody swinging like they're in the cage. So I'm complimenting guys. I mean, this one guy, he put a video up, and it was so comical that I had to make a meme out of it. It was probably some of my finest work. You dig down into my Twitter account, you'll find it, because it is hilarious. But at the same time, I really don't care what they teach as far as hitting goes. Everybody's got a new formula for success. I mean, when you hear guys say the big leaguers been doing it wrong, this is the way to do it, run. Because, again, if you're going to take advice from someone that's learning it offline, as opposed to somebody that's been thrown in the fire and having to figure it out and fight and scratch and claw and hold on to his career for any substantial amount of time, if you're going to listen to that first guy, then you deserve everything that you get. But I've always felt that experience is the best teacher. Now, don't get me wrong. I use the Rapsodo. I use Trackmaster. I use the Pocket Radar. Those are great tools to use.
Right.
And I use the data balls and all of this stuff that's going to give you spin rate and blah, blah, blah. But, and I showed a kid this the other day. I was like, I did two pitches. Now, one pitch he threw, perfect strike on the outside corner. Spin rate wasn't that high. You know, pitch efficiency was good because he located it. And then the next pitch he threw, the spin rate was off the charts. It had much more velocity, but it went over the backstop. And then I asked him, I said, now, which one of these pitches do you think is going to be more beneficial for you in the game? This one that you threw hard and had no direction where it was going, or this pitch that you painted on the lower outside corner? And so just the numbers, they're going to give you a measurement, but they still not going to tell you the whole story.
Right.
You know, you can execute. I knew guys that didn't have nothing going out there every 5 days getting people out because they knew how to pitch, they knew how to locate, they knew how to change speeds. And that formula is never going away, because hitting is all about timing. If you can destroy the timing, then you're going to make it difficult on the hitter. And so you can't destroy the timing just trying to throw the ball past guys all the time. A guy told me one time, he said, hey, man, he said, Free, you throw hard, but I could pull a bullet if I see it more than once. And I was like, you know what? I start thinking, and as a pitcher that actually had to go hit, when I knew a fastball was coming, I felt like Dave Winfield up there. my whole demeanor changed. But when I knew it was going to be something other than the fastball, I was like, man, I'm getting ready to strike out again, you know. So it changes your whole approach when you know that you're getting a fastball. And most of the time now, guys are they're getting fastballs,
right?
Because the numbers say that you throw 95 miles an hour, it's harder to hit. Well, I don't need a computer to tell me that, you know. But at the same time, you know, it's really good to know if your ball is spinning a certain kind of way, if you are trying to create this thing that kills me now is this pitch design. You know, you're designing new pitches now? Come on. Everybody's relabeling stuff. If my slider is hanging and I know I got to tighten it up to make it break shorter and quicker, then I got to do something different. I don't need a spin machine to tell me that my breaking ball is just rolling. I mean, and a lot of stuff that we talk about as former big leaguers, we can see with our eyes. And so we have a better chance of correcting it right there on the spot. We don't have to go to the numbers, but I use the numbers now because, again, I'm like Jurassic Park, the dinosaur that's brought into today's world. And we already saw how Jurassic Park ended. They killed all the dinosaurs. And so I'm just trying to survive as that dinosaur out here using the tools that they're using now and still kind of blending it with the way the game should be played so guys can get the most out of their own ability.
Hey, Jurassic Park had a lot of sequels and reboots, so
there you go.
They always go back to the well. And I'm sure you would have liked to have faced guys that are like doing this kind of swing and whatever this twist is. You would have loved to face guys like that.
Oh, you know what? The thing is now, there's so many shifts, and they're shifting guys before a pitcher even goes out there. And because some days I had a really good fastball, some days I didn't throw it that much. But if you're playing everybody to pull, and I got a really good fastball and they're hitting the ball the other way, then that's not playing into what I'm trying to do. So that's what I have. I have a big problem with shifting everybody on one side of the field. But here's the kicker. The hitters are trying to hit over the shift. I don't get that part. You got the whole left side open. You can just kind of like just poke a ball and walk to first.
Yeah.
And, you know, guys are just like, hey, well, you know, the numbers say you get it in the air and you're going to get more doubles and home runs by getting the ball in the air. Well, if a pitcher can locate away and the hitter is swinging to lift, then I'd say it's advantage pitcher because most of the time you're going to pull off that ball away. I'm not talking about the super elite major leaguers that can go the other way. I'm talking about young little league, high school, college level players that are trying to hit like they see guys in the majors hit when they can't even cover the entire plate. So I'm teaching pitchers, hey, control the outside corner. Make sure you can get your breaking ball over. You're going to eliminate half the guys in the lineup. Now, the other half, you might have to bear down and make some good pitches on. But if you can control the outside part of the plate, it's going to make it easier for you as a pitcher. So I keep it simple. I try not to be so scientific with things. I explain it in a way that these guys are going to get the most out of it. And then it's up to them to execute.
Yeah, I could listen to you talk all day about pitching and everything. So, you know, I want to get to the wrap so I can give you time to get to what you got to do today. Okay. But please tell the listeners of Diamond Conversations where they can find everything going on in the world of Marvin Freeman. Like I said, Freeman Baseball, your youth foundation, anything you got out there, please share with us right now.
Yeah, we got, you know, you can find me on Instagram, Freeman Baseball, Twitter, Marvin Freeman, Facebook, Freeman Baseball. We started a youth foundation to kind of bridge the gap with a lot of this cost for travel ball. We train kids in the off season for free on pitching. We have a youth program that's going to allow them to kind of get mentoring, and we give them life skills along the way, making them do community service to earn the right to come in and get the free training and stuff like that. So me and my wife created this foundation 2 years ago because we saw how a lot of times guys that had talent weren't really keeping up with the rest of the group because the rest of the group were paying to have training in the off season. And right now you gotta have some type of approach that you gotta learn other than just playing games. A lot of times games are being played and kids don't throw bullpens, so they don't get a chance to know what they're doing or feel. So we're kind of trying to bridge the gap with that. So it's Marvin Freeman Youth Foundation.org. We always welcome donations from anyone that wants to help out. It's a nonprofit 501c3 organization. So again, we're just trying to help guys become better human beings and learn baseball along the way. So that's pretty much the gist of what I'm doing. I'm spending most of my time trying to give it back. I've enjoyed a lot of success in this game, and it is time for me to kind of pass that on to, you know, the youth of tomorrow, and hopefully they'll have the ability to do the same thing to someone else. So we're just really just trying to pass it along, basically.
Awesome. No, well, I appreciate all the time today. This is a lot of fun. I could, like I said, talk to you all day about stuff I didn't even get into about your career. But I got to ask, who's the one guy we're never going to see any clips of popping up? Who's that one guy that you couldn't bear to face when you stepped in the box?
You know, it's funny because the one guy you wouldn't think of, it was David Segee. Over a 10-year period, I mean, the guy used to – I probably faced him two or three times a year. But I remember a game in Colorado, I was getting ready to pitch, and I was just looking at the stat sheets. They put all the numbers out on the table, and the pitcher – it's up to the pitcher to look at this stuff and see what guys have done against you in the past. And I looked at it, and I'm like, 10 for 11? Wait a minute. I said, is this a misprint, you know? And I looked at his spray chart, and he had like 7 hits directly over second base. So I told Eric Young, he's my second baseman, I said, look, man, we're going to do a little something different today. I said, when I'm pitching against Segee, almost stand on second base. And sure enough, the first ball he hit, it went right through my legs, but EY was standing right at second. And threw him out first. And he gets on first, and he's looking like, what are you doing there? I'm like, hey, man, I finally looked at the spray chart, and, you know, I got him out 3 times. But he ended up hitting like 835 or
84,
wow. Some ridiculous number. And then Jeff Conine. Now, Jeff Conine treated me like I was his little son. Like I was sitting on his lap every day. He punished me. And I'm talking about with some jacks. He's probably one of the few guys that's got more than one home run off me in my career. But it was just, you know, them two guys right there had my number, man. But Barry Larkin, I owned him. He's a Hall of Famer. I always throw him out because he mentioned me in his Hall of Fame speech. He said they asked him who was the toughest pitcher he ever faced. And he said, this guy named Marvin Freeman, I was like, you know me, man. Don't be trying to pretend like he was 1 for 20 off of me.
Oh, and, wow.
He got his hit the last game that I pitched against the Reds in 96. He finally got a hit. He was 0 for 20 at one point, and then he finally got a hit. And so Barry, Eric Davis, you know, Straw was a guy that, you know, when I was in college, he played for the Jackson Mets in AA. And I went to Jackson State. So we used to hang out, you know, when he was in the minors. And I used to tell him, yeah, man, I'm going to be up there in a couple of years. I got something for you. Then he shot me over the Big Apple in New York. So it was just fun facing them guys that, you know, you grew up watching. And then you finally get a chance to face Andre Dawson. I got so many stories, man.
I know. I can sit here and talk to you all day. I know. We'll wrap it up. I'd love to have you back because I want to talk. We haven't even gotten into the powder blue uniforms of the Phillies yet. That's how much I want to talk to you about stuff. So we'll get into that another time. But, like, I sincerely appreciate the time today. I told you we'd have a good time. And, you've been listening to Diamond Conversations. You can follow me on Twitter. It's at ChadEMB. And for Marvin Freeman, again, Marvin, what's the Twitter handle? I wrote it down here. It's at Marvin Freeman 84 on Twitter.
Marvin Freeman 84 on Twitter.
Yeah, all right.
That was the year I came up, 84.
That's right. Now, go follow Marvin Freeman. If you're an old baseball enthusiast, you will not be any bit disappointed. So I appreciate you coming on, and we'll catch you next time.
All right. Take care, man.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following. Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place to Be Nation wrestling feed. We dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture.